Here at Stories of Hope, Kerry Atherton's mission is to give people a platform to share their stories of hope with the world. We also want to provide the same chance to businesses that are passionate about mental health and want to support the podcast. If you'd like to partner with Stories of Hope and advertise your services on this podcast, send a message to kerry@empowerlifesolutions.com.au with your details. Now, on with the episode. In times of trauma and adversity, we must create space for connection by sharing a story of hope. Welcome to Stories of Hope Worldwide, hosted by Kerry Atherton. This podcast shares inspiring stories of individuals who have faced significant challenges and emerged stronger, offering hope and resilience to listeners all over the world. Join Kerry, the founder of Stories of Hope, every week to hear these remarkable journeys and find strength to overcome your adversity. Now, let's listen in to this week's conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Stories of Hope Worldwide. I'm Kerry Atherton and I'm your host. And today's guest is Danny Shannon. Danny is on a journey of recovery. He has 14 years up now, clean and sober after a grueling heroin addiction. Today's episode is for anyone who is struggling with addiction and feels like they've lost hope. Hi, Danny. Welcome to Stories of Hope.
Hey, thanks so much, Kerry. 13 years, 4 months, and 23 days. There's no credit. Yeah, I can't accept the 14 years, you know.
Oh, I know, because it's one day at a time.
Yeah, I can't be accepting an extra 6 months. But thank you so much for the introduction.
Congratulations, Danny. Like, that's incredible. And heroin addiction is just such a soul-destroying addiction. Any addiction is. As we know, I'm on the journey as well, and it's one day at a time, isn't it?
Absolutely. It certainly is. And, I'm so lucky, Gary. I've got the amazing life. I treasure every day. Like, and I know that sounds really cliche, but maybe, like, through this interview you'll find out, like, I often, because I connect with a lot of people on a daily basis, and mostly people are struggling, you know, and they're asking for help. And sometimes people say, like, how do you do it? But actually, and I don't want to get cocky again either, but it just feels really easy at the moment, you know. Life's really good.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And it is. I love hearing that, because I know that for so long, in the thick of addictions, and even in the early days of recovery, the pain, the emotional pain, is excruciating. And so
hearing
that people in recovery are having good days, I just love nothing more than that.
Yeah. Oh, it's excruciating. I love the word. It was just madness. So the first, I'm going to say even 2 years, but there was definitely a moment at 10 months. But I would say the first 2 years was up and down, like anxiety. I hadn't experienced anxiety in my addiction because I was just on the nod on heroin most of the time, you know. So I know people on heroin do experience anxiety, but I didn't. I didn't really experience sadness. I definitely got angry if I didn't get on, but I didn't experience really many emotions until I got clean and sober, and, you know, then it hit me like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, so true. And I talk with my clients about this because I've been an addictions counsellor for 15 years now.
Yeah, right.
And talk to my clients about this particular fact, learning to sit with pain and learning to process that. And they're so surprised when they first stop drinking or stop the substances or whatever it is, and how much they're feeling the different emotions, you know, the sadness, the anger, the anxiety, the fear. And I explain to them it's because whenever you used to feel that, you used to go and drink the pain away or ingest the pain away. And now, you know, now with no anesthetic as such, you have to sit there and get used to feeling the feelings. And it's such a new thing, isn't it, for somebody in recovery?
Yeah, definitely. And you can't be told. Well, I couldn't be told either. Like, for example, from pain comes growth. I love that. It's so true, yeah? But you can't be told that when you're in pain in early days. Just like, yeah, Danny, get stuff. Like, don't tell me. But it's not until you sort of reflect in hindsight that you can see that the growth happens. And you just look, it's like any problem as well. I feel like you can't work through something if you're not in it. Like, often anyway. That's my experience anyway, you know?
So true. On your social media, you have a saying, and it says, do not leave before the miracle happens.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. When I read that, I was like, every person that is in the thick of addictions, especially when they've hit rock bottom, knows what that means.
Yeah.
And me too, you know, and so many of us. And I want to give a trigger warning now that today, you know, we may be talking about sensitive topics such as suicide or abuse or, you know, different things that come with that journey. But at 18, you know, I almost left before the miracle happened. The day I planned to end my life. And like you, you know, and having been in the rooms for, you know, 40 years, I've walked alongside thousands and thousands of people who are recovering from drug and alcohol addiction. And I never not hear that they all wanted to check out at some stage. Mm. But fortunately, they didn't leave before the miracle happened because they're still here today.
Absolutely. And I love just that we just touched on that, all those other, but this, like, yeah, I know thousands of people on this same journey. And often I think, I just want to sort of give some acknowledgement to those people too, because, for example, like you and I right now, we're in a position where we're getting to share our recovery. I just want to, acknowledge that, you know, I do know hundreds, if not thousands of people who are also on the exact same journey as me. We all have ups and downs, but and killing it in life too. And I don't know that community is so aware of the amazing recovery that is happening everywhere around us, you know? I think it's really important to acknowledge that stuff because, like, this stigma or whatever it is, I think community, this is my interpretation, don't realize how much recovery there is going on. Like, I can't walk out my door, literally for 50 meters without bumping into another person I know in recovery, you know, like we're everywhere.
It's almost like, I don't know whether you get this sense, and that's why I love that we're having this conversation, because when it comes to dishing out the funding and stuff like that, it's like addiction rehabs just shoved under the carpet. And I get this sense that from a lot of society that there's not a lot of empathy, and that there's this opinion that, oh, yeah, you're an addict or alcoholic, you know, you chose that path.
Yeah, right.
I don't know about you, but I reckon there's a lot of stigma around addiction.
Yeah, for sure. Again, one thing, I don't know how it happened or where, how I got to the position where I am in today, where I basically, I do know where it happened, but because I've been talking about addiction out loud in a public forum like this for quite some time now, it's almost like I've forgotten that idea that of the stigma, because to me, my whole life, it's just surrounded by this stuff. Like, I've got plenty of time off it as well. Well, not plenty of time, actually. I've got moments of time off it. Like, for example, at the gym, which I'm kind of known as the residential drug and alcohol worker at the gym, but it's kind of like I get a little bit of time off there. But the point is, maybe that's what really goes in my favor, because I really have no stigma attached to it. Just tell the truth. That's what I do. And I think people see that I do that often. And that's sometimes why I'm able to connect with a bunch of people and make them feel a little bit comfortable about talking about it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So you all call yourself Dan the Man. I want to know, why is Danny the man that people want to seek inspiration from?
Okay.
Because when we see the person sitting here today that is recovered and walking the walk and talking the talk, nobody sees the path that it took to get there, what they've been through and how it all started.
Yeah, sure. Before we go back, let me just address that little statement about me calling myself Dan the Man. Yeah. What happened with that is I needed a name that rolled off the tongue. I worked out with some other incredible mentors, one of them being a dude called TikTok Gary. TikTok Gary. Like, you know what? And I used to go by this one, Recovering Danny. It doesn't roll off the tongue. It's a horrible name. It's a beautiful sentiment, but recovering, who wants to say that? Dan the Man, it rolls off the tongue. So there's actually a lot of thought put into it. And I also acknowledge that it's a bit of a, it sounds, anyway, but it is a good name. And I have sort of come to be known by that name. Well, I certainly don't say it out loud, but it's on my profiles and some of my social media. So, Kerry, did you go back, picked up drugs and alcohol at a young age, 14, got got drunk, stoned, and there was these other little things called cream bulbs, nitric oxide, not a good combination. But anyway, I had all three of them. I was 14. I was at this outdoor roller skating rink, and we had a bit of a party with some older kids. And that was the night I was introduced to, you know, like I said, alcohol, pot, and those chilling nangs. And I remember waking up, like, sort of from being smashed on that outdoor roller skating rink with a few bodies laying around, some broken glass, and thinking, wow, that was great. Let's do it again. And I say that because I feel like maybe that's the difference between maybe a normal kid and me. And that's kind of the path that led me possibly into, like, full-blown heroin addiction just 2 years later. Just for the record, Mum and Dad were just in between a bit of a split up. We moved up to Bundaberg. I was with some older kids that my family knew. So as far as Mum knew, I was just out with, you know, some mates. Yeah, that was the beginning. That was my introduction to alcohol. I did have a cigarette, I reckon maybe at about 10 years old. And I remember being really sneaky about that. Of course, a kid's going to be sneaky, but I wonder if it did go back to that cigarette or if it was that time I picked up alcohol, you know. But yeah, that was the beginning of it.
Would have you said that you were a risk-taking kid?
Oh, big, big, big time. I was a very no brains at all. Like, I've had so many injuries from death-defying things, you know. Even as a kid, you know, grew up with motorbikes. Just I was always, yeah, always going that extra length. That's a really good point. Like, I guess that helped. I mean, a lot of kids are like that. Doesn't mean they're going to pick up drink and alcohol and drugs, I mean, and go on for it. But the next couple, the next year and a half after picking up, I dabbled with a whole range of things, you know, like amphetamines, LSD, magic mushrooms, cocaine, anything but heroin. It's like up until that stage, I tried everything else. So I'd moved back to Sydney from being in Bundaberg. I was kind of living at mates' houses at a young age as well, because Mum and Dad had tried to do their thing and separate. And I've kind of played them against one another. And basically, I just wanted to be left alone so I could drink and drug. And then I picked up heroin. I'm sitting in a car at the front of this guy who's about to go and score heroin for us. I'm with my best mate, who was kind of my co-offender, the guy I used to sort of commit crimes with as well. And I remember thinking, this is a bad idea, you know. Like,
how old were you then, Danny?
I was almost 16. I was 15.
Wow.
I remember sitting in that car. I don't know if I've imagined this, but I can remember the day sitting in the back of a yellow Gemini, thinking, this is a bad idea. You know, we're about to pick someone up who's going to take us to Cabramatta to buy heroin. But I reckon peer pressure played a big part in this. You know, there was a couple other people in the car, a couple of older people who had done it before. And I thought, all right. And Kerry, that was the beginning of the end, mate. That day I was taken into a flat in Cabramatta, and I was injected heroin into my arm in a flat that had no furniture. Just this dingy little flat in Cabra, and I remember the feeling that I got that day. And if I had enjoyed anything I'd done up until that point, it was nothing like what was happening that day, you know. And that was kind of my introduction to a full blown heroin addiction, which was going to come very quickly. I never missed a day, basically, for the next 17 years. So if people wonder, is heroin really that addictive? Well, I didn't miss a day for the next 17 years, you know? Yeah.
You didn't even have time in that addiction, like, because with alcohol and different drugs, you take it, you get the high, and then you come down, and then the shame and remorse set in, you know, that cycle of addiction, and then sure, you pick up again. So you never even really got the opportunity to feel those feelings of regret and shame before you were back into it again.
No, well, if you go back to the thing about the kind of daring kid, there was none of that anyway. There was no, I don't know, like, well, really, I wasn't hurting anyone except for me. So there was no shame attached or guilt. Maybe there should have been. I never thought of it, but I just got stoned. Like, it was just, I guess already by that stage, I'd already, you know, left school, been kicked out of school. I'd already been living not on the streets, but couch surfing. Because I'd split Mum and Dad up. I've sort of played them against one another to leave me alone somewhat. So I guess I was already, you know, that's a really good point because I often don't look back, even through all the carnage and damage I've caused. People often say, Danny, would you change anything? And I can't say I would because I love who I am right now. And I wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for that stuff.
Yeah. I actually read, because I, you know, did a little bit of reading up before I interviewed you. And I did read about one day that you talked about deep regret. And that was the day that you drove, you're involved high speed car chase.
Did you read that? Yeah.
Your little boy in the back seat.
Yeah. Wow.
Is that just a normal day or was that?
It was pretty much a normal day. And well done. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, look, so when I say I wouldn't change a thing, I definitely wish something didn't happen, of course. Like there's definitely people I wish I hadn't have hurt along the way. But that incident you're talking about, there was actually a couple of incidents like that. But that one that you might have read was where I was involved in a high-speed police pursuit with the kid in the back in a stolen car. That day I got away. They didn't catch me. But there was another time where my poor mom, like imagine this. Imagine I was actually on the run. I've got my kid in the back seat of the car. I'm demanding some money off my mum because she had my money. It wasn't as if I was demanding off her, but she had some money on mine. She's come to meet me at McDonald's in Wetherill Park and had to hand over cash while I've got my kid in the back seat, knowing that what the money must be for. Imagine that. Like as I say that out loud, it almost puts a tear in my eye because I can't. Possibly for my mum, I can't imagine what she would have went through. And I would say to anybody else's mum in that position, call the cops on me, you know, like call the police, report me straight away. Like my mum did not deserve that and I didn't deserve to be free. Like the cops should have pinched me right then and thrown me straight in the cell. And I mean, that sounds pretty harsh, but I mean it. Like, and if I catch anyone else doing that, trust me, I'll be ringing the cops on you as well.
Yeah, but it's a really good point that you make there. And I have a lot of mums ring me and say, you know, usually it's an adult son.
Yeah.
And, you know, I often explain to them, I read this book by a psychologist to the stars, an addiction specialist, Jeff von Bondrum. I don't know if you've heard.
No.
And he's working over in America in all those, you know, celebrity rehabs and everything. And he talks about the tightrope. When it comes to family members and loved ones watching on, you know, to the addiction of their loved one. And he explains it like this, that it's like watching your loved one up on a tightrope balancing. They'll do anything to stop them from falling. And they'll even do what they don't agree with in their heart. They'll do on the outside, like give the money, make excuses, you know, the what we call the enabling. But the sad reality is eventually that person has to fall from the tightrope.
Yeah, I just remember my mum driving me to buy heroin one day. Imagine that.
Wow, yeah.
She had to because, like, I don't know, I manipulated her in some way, but it's like if she didn't take me that day and give me the money, something else I would have manipulated it somehow.
Yeah. And the fear for every parent is that if I don't help them get the drugs, they might die.
Yeah.
And that's the fear that every loved one goes through. And it's a very, very tragic journey for the family of people battling addictions because they're left in the hard, cold reality, whereas the addict or alcoholic is in a state of delusion until they're lulled out by their rock bottom.
Yeah, so true. It's a horrible, horrible thing. And one of the things I always talk about is this, right? Like in addiction, even at my lowest of low, living homeless under the bridge in Woolloomooloo, hanging out desperate for a fix, or even being locked up in a cell in Silverwater in like a dry cell with no mattress, in withdrawals. Like even then, even those days, I still had hope that I was going to get on. And pretty much I would. Like there's nothing would stop me. My lowest of low was nowhere near as bad as the stuff my mum and my dad, maybe not my dad was pretty kicked back, but my mum would have been through, you know, like I truly believe that the loved ones are the real victims of addiction, you know. And look, it's easy for me to say that because I didn't take my life and, you know, I'm not heavily affected by mental health issues today. But, mate, I was always going to get stoned and change the way I feel. But my family didn't have that, did they? They were just in this desperation. So, yeah, my love goes out to them people more than anything, you know?
Yeah. Mm. And, you know, you got such a love of life today, Danny. What was it, though? So was it did you want to escape? Did you just see it as a party for you? You know, for people watching out there, or, you know, what was it for you that made you want to get on it every day?
Look, we talk about it being a family disease and, you know, passed down from this to that or childhood. Well, I just want to say for me, I kind of had a pretty cool childhood. My mum was this beautiful, loving mum. My dad was a criminal for sure. He taught me everything I shouldn't know. My mum taught me everything I should know. I had a lot of mates as a young kid because I was a pretty good skateboard rider, and that would attract the friends. But what happened is when I did pick up, I just loved it and I just continued going on with it. So no blame at all on anything. For me, I just, I don't know, maybe it was something in my genes that just said, yeah, this is what your goal is, Danny, to get stoned, to get smashed, to change the way you feel.
As you hear this story, what Kerry's discussing might be resonating strongly with you. Perhaps you've experienced something similar yourself and are looking for support. Kerry Atherton is an experienced counsellor and well-being coach and has private sessions available if you or someone you know needs some help. You don't have to deal with trauma, addiction, PTSD and abuse alone. If you'd like to talk about today's episode or your own experiences, book a session with Kerry at empowerlifesolutions.com.au or check the link in the show notes and embrace a future filled with hope. Now back to the episode.
Danny, what was your lowest point? We all have a few. I think we all have a few rock bottoms, but the true rock bottom is the wake-up call, isn't it, that causes us to change direction and take action towards a better life.
Yeah, cool. So I got caught on methadone maybe at the age of 21, and I was on it for the next 12 or 13 years. And here's the thing, right? In that time, I was constantly stoned. Like, I had this security blanket of methadone that was just coating me, and I was on a pretty good dose too. So I was literally stoned from 21 to 33 permanently, right? And I got clean at 34, right? So I feel like that 13 years was just one long, slow rock bottom. And I know, like, I love what you said, there's got to be one moment. But in that time, I attempted detox and rehab a bunch of times. I'd often go to detox just to have a rest because I started using amphetamines as well. And on amphetamines, like, you have, you're up. And if I go to detox, at least I could get my dose and just have a sleep for a few days. Like, I just needed to reset the body. And I guess I always had hope. Well, my family certainly had hope that every time I went in there that I would change my life, but it just wasn't like that. I would just be in and out. In that time, like I said, I was homeless, living under a bridge in Woolloomooloo. I've been in prison, in withdrawals, no dose of methadone, hanging out. But mostly it was 13 years of misery and also 13 years of kind of a bit of a glow as well. And I just found that in 2009, when I entered my very last detox on the 15th of September 2009, actually maybe it was a few days before that, I entered my last detox and I took drugs in with me like I always would, if I certainly could anyway.
It's,
you know,
the ultimate risk-taking, that, isn't it?
Oh, it's just like, it's like, I don't think I ever really had intentions of getting off it. You take drugs, you go there to hide from the police or whatever it was. I ran out of those drugs and I'm clean. I'm one day clean and I'm ringing detoxes from the book, the resources book. I mean, I'm ringing rehabs from the detox and I got accepted into another program. I went there. It was a 28-day program. At that program, I was doing everything wrong. I had my mobile phone stashed on me, which you weren't allowed to have. I was involved in this tax rort that was going around Sydney at the time where you could get $5,000 if you filled out this stuff, this paperwork. I'm doing everything wrong, right? But I'm not stoned. And also that time, after 50 rehabilitation attempts, I thought I've got to do something different. And I started, while I was in that rehab, I started writing. I did a short journal every day, something I did well today.
Yeah.
something I could do better tomorrow, and I did five things I was grateful for.
Oh, yeah.
And I just started writing, and that was kind of the big difference for me. And I don't know if I'll just add this. Like, on Christmas Day 2009 was the day my life changed forever. That was the turning point. I'll share this with you. So it was Christmas Day. I was in rehab, another rehab, which I went to after that 28-day program. I was on my way home for Christmas Day to visit the family. And let me tell you, I did not want to go. Like, I was never someone who was a family person, especially because of the shame and guilt. There definitely was a lot of shame and guilt then. And anyway, I'm sitting around the family Christmas table on Christmas Day, say 15 people at that table that I'd hurt, stolen, robbed every single one of them, you know, neighbors, cousins, mom, dad, sister, her friends. Oh, the shame is just too much. And on my way back to rehab that day, I decided, you know what, I can't do this. I'm gonna get on. I had money from Christmas, as always, you know, and I stood at the crossroads. Kerry, I'm at Town Hall Station to my right.
I know it well.
Is King's Cross. I know I can get on. 100% I can buy some cocaine and I can buy some heroin, and that's what I wanted, both of them. I wanted both because my head had been, like, that obsession was there. But on the other side of the road was a bus to go back to the rehab. And that day I decided, you know, I thought about what was going to happen. You know, I'd never done this before. I thought, if I go up there, I know I'm going to end up back in rehab, probably back in jail, maybe dead, or I never knew what it'd be like to not do it. I'd always just thrown everything away. And that day I made a different decision for the first time in my life. I didn't get on. And I crossed the road, I went on, got on the bus, and a miracle happened that day. I have not come close to picking up another drink or a drug since Christmas Day 2009. Just obsession and compulsion just left me. I've not come close to picking up another drink or a drug since.
Gosh, that is a miracle, isn't it? When
that is a miracle.
Sleeps. And now I know why you're like, do not leave before the miracle happens.
Yeah, Kerry, that day was the miracle. Look, I've certainly been in a lot of pain along my journey, and there's been times where I've wanted to do other things, but not. I haven't really come close to using again since that day.
Did you ever go to NA or a 12-step programs?
Yeah, of course. I every day for the first couple of years. This is why I'm still here. I truly believe it. I threw myself in the middle of the program. I did every single thing that they suggested I do. I did everything you shouldn't do as well. Harry, don't get me wrong. I did all the wrong things, but I did everything right as well. And I felt like if I do one bad thing, I need to do two good things. And that was kind of my recipe for success, I guess.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, I still go. I go pretty much two or three or four times a week, you know.
Oh, wow. Well, if I was in Sydney, I'd be seeing you there.
Yeah, definitely.
Just for anyone that's listening, you know, that might be early on in this journey, you talked about doing the right things. And one of the things that, you know, we know is getting rid of the old environment and having a new supportive environment of people is just really vital, isn't it, to moving forward?
So they say the opposite to addiction is connection. Yeah. So, and get out of the house, you're at home with the killer. I love that one because so I needed to get connected with people, but I could not stand people. And when I say I couldn't stand people, I was just petrified. I had the fear. The fear in me was so strong. So what I want to say is that rehab for me was huge. Like, I always had this little crew. I went to this incredible rehab in Sydney here that it was only a small rehab, but we used to go to the same meetings together often. And it was like I always had some people I knew, and I'd always venture out every single meeting and I'd put my hand out to somebody and just say, hey, mate, how you doing? I started to practice being brave, having some courage and reaching out, because if you don't, yeah, what's changing? I had to start doing something different. So that was very valuable for me. I did get involved. I had a mentor, you know, a sponsor. I started doing writing work from the steps, from the 12 steps. I got myself a service position as well. I found myself a higher power. I did all the stuff, you know.
That's great. And I love it how you talk about serving, because my dad actually was sober for 60 years in AA when he passed away. And he watched both his parents die of alcoholism in their 50s. And he used to talk about feeling like a raw exposed nerve. He had a lot of post-traumatic stress from his childhood, you know. So even sober, he would feel like that often at times. But the antidote for that is when we do serve and give to others, because we're getting our mind off ourselves. And that's such a healing thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so true. I reckon it's like I've got five things that I kind of just mentioned them there, but number five and probably the most important one is service to mankind. Like the more you give, the more the universe provides, and we only keep what we have by giving it away. So the most powerful thing I think I can do, and this is what I'm blessed because I can't help but do it every day now anyway. It's what I do. Yeah. Is just give back to people, you know. So yeah, it's one of the real big tricks to keeping our sanity and moving forward too, I think.
That's great, Danny. And look, could you tell us what your greatest moment has been since sobriety?
Yeah.
You don't even drink now. I just want to kind of add that in. You don't even drink alcohol. You're like totally clean and sober, aren't you?
I guess what? I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't take drugs, I don't even swear at the moment. This is just a new thing, but and who cares? Like, I've got nothing against swearing. I love it. I think in so many levels, but I love the idea that someone challenged me just recently, and I thought maybe they're right. Maybe I do have a bad mouth and I need to stop, so it's worth a try. But my greatest moment, there's one thing I think about every day since 2017. I went on an incredible trip to America in a camper van. I traveled from LA to New York via Florida. We went on a cruise to Jamaica doing NA the whole way and training at Anytime Fitness. So we'd literally go from town to town each day. I'd find a new Anytime Fitness that I could go and train at, use the showers and stuff and use as a base. We went to a meeting, a 12-step fellowship meeting. And along that journey, I met so many incredible people who actually got me here right now, because there's all these entrepreneurs in America. They don't have the services available like we, or like I had here. I won't say we. I know I've been very lucky to have the public system look after me for a long, long time, you know. But over there, they had nothing. And I got really inspired to come back from that trip and develop my own business, which is Encapsulator. I don't know if you've heard anything about Encapsulator.
Yeah, well, I was looking it up a little bit. I thought I must talk to you a bit more about that.
I'll just give you a brief. So, yeah, I celebrated about 6 years clean. I was working at a rehab at the time, and I was full of gratitude. And I remember sitting in the office on the opposite side of the desk where I was once a client, and because of the same rehab I went through, right? It's in Glebe in Sydney, but okay. I wonder what I was like when I entered this place. You know, what was I thinking? What was I feeling? And I came up with this idea to record a video to my future self for my 10-year birthday. As I did that video, I did a bit of research and some questions I could answer. I had them in front of me. I started the camera rolling. And as I was talking, I just noticed this really beautiful, unique therapeutic process. This was me talking to my future self. I thought about my mom, my dad, my son, and I got quite teary because I thought, well, first of all, I hope I'm still alive. I've lost a lot of people due to heroin overdose in recovery. I thought, I hope my mom, my dad's alive, and I also hope I've got a good relationship with my son and all this other stuff. And I noticed myself talking about stuff that I'd never really spoken about before. It's almost like just daydreaming in your head because there's no one to judge you. So you can literally say anything. And I started to enjoy that process. I then started capturing all the clients. I captured about 250 clients over the next few years using the same concept in that program I worked at and giving their videos back to them 1 or 2 years later. And then I developed Encapsulator. So in America, they inspired me to come back and start this concept, a web platform that allows individuals to record video messages of love and hope to their future self, a tool to measure your growth from beginning to end and express yourself without fear of judgment. So time capsule video programs by Encapsulator. That's a quick pitch to it.
That's gold. You know, and there's this verse that says, without a vision, people perish.
Oh, yeah, wow, beautiful.
And, you know, that's something that I I know for myself and for everybody I work with, it's actually in the Bible. So there you go. But that's something that without a vision, people perish. A vision and a purpose is the other thing that I think is vital for anybody that's struggling in life to move forward.
That's amazing. Yeah. Look, well, when we verbalize our goals out loud,
yeah,
it adds this extra level of accountability and motivation as we progress towards our goals. Then imagine on top of that, you've got a video that's going to be delivered to your inbox in 3, 6, 12 months' time. Knowing that, it's almost like that message is coming. I better get my ass into gear. Maybe not always, and people fall off the wagon all the time, but even those people felt after watching their videos that it helped motivate them to get their butt back on track as well. So there's a lot of benefits. Yeah, we're still grinding. Hopefully, well, it will. Soon it will be known as in the top 5 mental health apps in the world. Karen, encapsulated. Keep an ear out for it.
Oh, I will. And because I do a lot of work with men's mental health, and I've just written a new book, Light Bulb Moments Through
the Eyes of Men.
And basically my desire is exactly what your message says, that people don't leave before the miracle happens.
Yeah.
And that they don't wait until all the crap hits the fan, that they don't wait for that massive wake-up call, that by listening to the lived experience stories, especially, and I'm working with this with men at the moment because women find it so much easier to open up to one another, but men have, especially, you know, the guys between the 35 to 55 age bracket still have a fear of the judgment of opening up. But by reading stories in a book of other guys at their lowest point and how they found hope and about the emotions that they went through, the person that's going through something can read that and go, if they can make it, I can make it as well.
Yeah, look, it's so powerful. Like indirectly carrying the message like that is probably one of the most powerful ways we can do it to you. Because confronting, if somebody's in front of you telling you, there's a wall, there's resistance straight away. But if people can trust and read and hear those stories of hope and encouragement, I think it's a wonderful way to carry the message, you know.
Thank you, Danny. And you're a great story of hope. I'm so
thank you.
That you came.
I'm blessed. I'm very, very lucky, you know.
There's two questions that I ask towards the end, and they're like, it's a big question. What's been your greatest light bulb moment?
I've got a 5-year-old daughter who I had in recovery, and when I entered recovery in 2009, I was in rehab and I used to hear people talking about families, and I didn't get it because my poor son, he visited me in jail and institutions most of his life up until hit the age. At that time, he was about 8 when I entered recovery. So I didn't believe people that about family. I used to just think, you're full of it. Oh, I want to do this, I want to do that with my family. But then when Amalia was introduced to my life out of 6 years clean, I started to discover, and by this time I started to build a really good relationship with my son as well. And I've got to admit, like, it took me 5 or 6 years in recovery and working the steps for me to really build a strong relationship with my boy too. But I discovered, like, the meaning of unconditional love. And it honestly took me 6 years before I even had a glimpse of that. Like, I was so selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, didn't care about anybody else but myself for a long time, you know? Oh. So definitely to understand what that word of unconditional love and the love that my family can bring to me today is definitely the most, it's my drug, you know, the most inspirational thing I've had, I think.
And what's your message for the world as we close up on this great chat today?
If I think about like what I've just said, and I would definitely say don't ever give up, you know. I honestly, I kid you not, I had 49 rehabilitation attempts. And all right, maybe the number is hypothetical because I don't exactly know, but I was literally known on a first name basis at all our public systems, like McKinnon House, which isn't around anymore, Wisteria House, which isn't around anymore, Basement 82, which isn't around anymore, Gorman House, Herbert Street Clinic. I was such a regular at all these programs. I've been to William Booth, Odyssey House, Glebe House, Who's, Foundation House, Palm Court. Anyway, that's just to rattle off a few, right? Like, when I say 49 attempts, I'm not kidding. And what I want to just add to that is somebody planted some kind of a seed in my head at some point, and I believe that maybe one day I could do this. So don't ever give up is so important, because that day on Christmas Day when I did a different decision for the first time, it's like the stars and planets just aligned that day. It's like everything I'd heard, kind of, because I really was never listening, had just come to that one moment, and that day I made a different decision. So don't ever give up is a huge part of that. And then furthermore, that's not enough. I think if you talk about, remember I said I was scared, I had a lot of fear. I think I needed to practice courage and to be very brave and just get comfortable with being uncomfortable and sort of try and push through, because nobody else at the end of the day can do this for us, Gary. Like, no one else. Doesn't matter how much you love, how much money you got, whatever, you're the only one that can do this. So definitely don't ever give up. Be brave and just, yeah, push forward.
Wow, that's such an amazing story of hope.
Thank you so much.
And that psychologist I was talking about before, that talking about the tightrope, I just have to add this when you mentioned the 49 rehabs.
Yeah, yeah.
He came up with a number that was like a magic number from all the thousands of clients of the negative consequences that they have to face before they actually hit rock bottom. And the average number was 53.
Oh, I thought you were going to say 49.
Yeah. And that's anything from like
loss of
relationship, rehabs, jail. And it can happen earlier than that. And I want to give that encouragement for the loved ones of anyone battling addiction today.
Yes.
But like Danny, it doesn't have to get to the 53.
Yeah.
And you heard it from Danny. Do not leave before the miracle happens. It will happen.
By the way, that was a sign, an old wooden sign that was at the methadone rehab that I went through to get off the methadone. Just as a sign, it still hangs there today. It says, don't leave before the miracle happens.
Thanks so much for chatting today, Danny. It's been incredible.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you for listening to Stories of Hope with Kerry Atherton. If this conversation helped you, please consider sharing the podcast with a friend or leaving a rating and review on your podcast player. If you'd like to find out more about Kerry Atherton, head to storiesofhope.com.au, where you can purchase her books or find her next event. Check the show notes for links and information about our guest in this episode. And remember, you don't have to walk your path alone.